It was strange, though, how that sense of purpose, that sense of flocking, had seemed to loosen and fall apart. Afternoon, when he began to feel seriously sleepy, he went into the kitchen and found Alice dozing at the kitchen table, with her head in her arms. The little sneaker, the one she had called a baby Nike, was loosely clasped in one hand. When he woke her, she looked at him groggily and clasped it to the breast of her sweatshirt, as if afraid he would try to take it away. He asked if she could watch from the end of the hallway for a while without falling asleep again or being seen. She said she could. Clay took her at her word and carried a chair for her. She paused for a moment at the door to the living room. "Check it out," she said. He looked in over her shoulder and saw the cat, Rafe, was sleeping on Tom's belly. He grunted in amusement. She sat where he put the chair, far enough inside the door so someone who glanced at the house wouldn't see her. After a single look, she said, "They're not a flock anymore. What happened?"
"I don't know."
"What time is it?"
He glanced at his watch. 12:20.
"What time did we notice they were flocking?"
"I don't know, Alice." He was trying to be patient with her, but he could hardly keep his eyes open. 6:30, 7, I don't know, what does it matter?"
"If we could chart them, it might matter a lot, don't you think?"
He told her that he'd think about that when he'd had some sleep. "Couple of hours, then wake me or Tom," he said. "Sooner if something goes wrong."
"It couldn't go much wronger," she said softly. "Go on upstairs, you look really wasted."
He went upstairs to the guest bedroom, slipped off his shoes, and lay down. He thought for a moment about what she'd said. If we could chart them. She might have something there. Odds against, but maybe. It was a pleasant room, very pleasant, full of sun. You lay in a room like this, and it was easy to forget there was a radio in the closet you didn't dare turn on. Not so easy to forget your wife, estranged but still loved, might be dead, and your son, not just loved but adored, might be crazy. Still, the body had its imperatives, didn't it? And if there had ever been a room for an afternoon nap, this was the one. The panic rat twitched, but didn't bite, and Clay was asleep almost as soon as he closed his eyes. Chapter 17. This time Alice was the one who shook him awake. The little purple sneaker swung back and forth as she did it. She had tied it around her left wrist, turning it into a rather creepy talisman. The light in the room had changed. It was going the other way and diminished. He had turned on his side and he had to urinate, a reliable sign that he had slept for some time. He sat up in a hurry and was surprised, almost appalled, to see it was 6:15. He had slept for over 5 hours. But of course, last night hadn't been his first night of broken rest. He'd slept poorly the night before as well. Nerves, on account of his presentation to the Dark Horse Comics people.
"Is everything all right?" he asked, taking her by the wrist. "Why'd you let me sleep so long?" "Because you needed it," she said. "Tom slept until 2, and I slept until 4. We've been watching together since then. Come down and look. It's pretty amazing."
"Are they flocking again?"
She nodded. "But going the other way this time. And that's not all. Come and see."
He emptied his bladder and hurried downstairs. Tom and Alice were standing in the doorway to the porch with their arms around each other's waists. There was no question of being seen now. The sky had clouded over, and Tom's porch was already thick with shadows. Only a few people were left on Salem Street anyway. All of them were moving west, not quite running, but going at a steady clip. A group of 4 went past in the street itself, marching over a sprawl of bodies and a litter of discarded food which included the leg of lamb, now gnawed down to the bone, a great many torn open cellophane bags and cardboard boxes, and a scattering of discarded fruits and vegetables. Behind them came a group of 6, the ones on the end, using the sidewalks. They didn't look at each other, but were still so perfectly together that when they passed Tom's house, they seemed for an instant to be only a single man. And Clay realized even their arms were swinging in unison. After them came a youth of maybe 14, limping along, bawling inarticulate cow sounds, and trying to keep up.
"They left the dead and the totally unconscious ones," Tom said, "but they actually helped a couple who were stirring."
Clay looked for the pregnant woman and didn't see her.
"Mrs. Scottoni?" "She was one of the ones they helped," Tom said.
"So they're acting like people again."
"Don't get that idea," Alice said.
One of the men they tried to help couldn't walk, and after he fell down a couple of times, one of the guys who'd been lifting him got tired of being a Boy Scout and just killed him, Tom said. Not with his hands, either, like the guy in the garden. With his teeth. Tore out his throat. I saw what was going to happen and looked away, Alice said. But I heard it. He squealed.
Easy, Clay said. He squeezed her arm gently. Take it easy.
Now the street was almost entirely empty. Two more stragglers came along, and although they moved more or less side by side, both were limping so badly there was no sense of unison about them.
Where are they going? Clay asked.
Alice thinks maybe inside, Tom said, and he sounded excited. Before it gets dark. She could be right.
Where are they going in? Have you seen any of them going into houses along this block?
No, they said it together.
They didn't all come back, Alice said. No way did as many come back up Salem Street as went down this morning, so a lot are still in Malden Center or beyond.
They may have gravitated toward public buildings like school gymnasiums.
School gymnasiums. Clay didn't like the sound of that.
Did you see that movie Dawn of the Dead? She asked.
Yes, Clay said. You're not going to tell me someone let you in to see it, are you? She looked at him as if he were nuts or old.
One of my friends had the DVD. We watched it at a sleepover back in 8th grade.
Back when the Pony Express still rode and the plains were dark with buffalo, her tone said.
In that movie, all the dead people, well, not all, but a lot, went back to the mall when they woke up.
Tom McCourt goggled at her for a second, then burst out laughing. It wasn't a little laugh either, but a long series of guffaws, laughter so hard he had to lean against the wall for support, and Clay thought it wise to shut the door between the hall and the porch. There was no telling how well the thing straggling up the street might hear. All he could think of at the moment was that the hearing of the lunatic narrator in Poe's The Telltale Heart had been extremely keen.
Well, they did, Alice said, putting her hands on her hips.
The baby sneaker flopped.
Straight to the mall.
Tom laughed even harder. His knees buckled, and he oozed slowly down to the hall floor, howling and flapping his hands against his shirt.
They died? He gasped. And came back? To go to the mall? Jesus Christ, is Jerry Falwell?
He went off into another gale. Tears were now running down his cheeks in clear streams. He brought himself under control enough to finish.
Does Jerry Falwell know heavens the Newcastle Mall?
Clay also began to laugh. So did Alice, although Clay thought she was a little bit pissed off that her reference had been greeted not with interest or even mild good humor, but outright howls. Still, when people started laughing, it was hard not to join in, even when you were pissed. They had almost stopped when Clay said, apropos of nothing,
"If heaven ain't a lot like Dixie, I don't want to go."
That set them off again, all three. Alice was still laughing when she said,
"If they're flocking, then roosting for the night in gyms and churches and malls, people could machine gun them by the hundreds."
Clay stopped laughing first. Then Tom stopped. He looked at her, wiping moisture out of his neat little mustache. Alice nodded. The laughter had brought high color to her cheeks, and she was still smiling. She had, at least for the moment, careened past pretty and into genuine beauty.
"By the thousands, maybe, if they're all going to the same place."
"Jesus," Tom said. He took off his glasses and began to wipe them, too. "You don't fool around."
"It's survival," Alice said matter-of-factly.
She looked down at the sneaker tied to her wrist, then up at the men. She nodded again.
"We ought to chart them. Find out if they're flocking and when they're flocking. If they're roosting and where they're roosting. Because if they can be charted..."
Chapter 18. Clay had led them out of Boston, but when the three of them left the house on Salem Street some 24 hours later, 15-year-old Alice Maxwell was unquestionably in charge. The more Clay thought about it, the less it surprised him. Tom McCourt didn't lack for what his British cousins called bottle, but he was not and never would be a natural leader. Clay had some leadership qualities, but that evening Alice had an advantage beyond her intelligence and desire to survive. She had suffered her losses and begun to move on. In leaving the house on Salem Street, both men were dealing with new ones. Clay had begun to suffer a rather frightening depression,
that at first he thought was just the result of his decision, unavoidable really, to leave his portfolio behind. As the night went on, however, he realized it was a profound dread of what he might find if and when he got to Kent Pond. For Tom, it was simpler. He hated to leave Rafe.
"Prop the door open for him," Alice said,
the new and harder Alice, who seemed more decisive by the minute.
"He'll almost certainly be okay, Tom. He'll find plenty of forage. It'll be a long time before the cat starve or the phone crazies work their way down the food chain to cat meat."
"He'll go feral," Tom said. He was sitting on the living room couch, looking stylish and miserable in a belted raincoat and trilby hat. Rafer was on his lap, purring and looking bored.
"Yeah, that's what they do," Clay said. "Think of all the dogs, the little ones and the oversized ones, that are just going to flat die."
"I've had him for a long time. Since he was a kitten, really."
He looked up, and Clay saw the man was on the verge of tears.
"Also, I guess I see him as my luck. My mojo. He saved my life, remember?"
"Now we're your mojo," Clay said. He didn't want to point out that he himself had almost certainly saved Tom's life once already, but it was true. "Right, Alice?"
"Yep,"
she said. Tom had found a poncho for her, and she wore a knapsack on her back, although there currently was nothing in it but batteries for the flashlights, and Clay was quite sure that creepy little sneaker, which was at least no longer tied to her wrist. Clay was also carrying batteries in his pack, along with the Coleman lantern. They had nothing else, at Alice's suggestion. She said there was no reason for them to carry what they could pick up along the way.
"We're the Three Musketeers, Tom. All for one, and one for all. Now let's get over to the Nicklebys' house and see if we can get some muskets."
"Nickerson." He was still stroking the cat. She was smart enough and compassionate enough, maybe that too, not to say something like, "whatever," but Clay could see she was getting low in the patience department. He said, "Tom, time to go."
"Yeah, I suppose."
He started to put the cat aside, then picked it up and kissed it firmly between the ears. Rafe bore it with no more than a slight narrowing of the eyes. Tom put it down on the sofa and stood.
"Double rations in the kitchen by the stove, kiddo," he said, "plus a big bowl of milk, with the rest of the half and half poured in for good measure. Back door's open. Try to remember where home is, and maybe I'll see you."
The cat jumped down and walked out of the room toward the kitchen with its tail up, and true to its kind, it never looked back. Clay's portfolio, bent and with a horizontal wrinkle running both ways from the knife slash in the middle, leaned against the living room wall. He glanced at it on the way by and resisted an urge to touch it. He thought briefly of the people inside he'd lived with so long, both in his little studio and in the much wider, or so he liked to flatter himself, reaches of his imagination. Wizard Flack, Sleepy Jean, Jumping Jack Flash, Poison Sally, and the Dark Wanderer, of course. 2 days ago he'd thought that maybe they were going to be stars. Now they had a hole running through them, and Tom McCourt's cat for company. He thought of Sleepy Jean leaving town on Robbie the Robo Cayuse, saying, "So long, boys. Maybe I'll be back this way again." "So long, boys," he said out loud, a little self-conscious, but not very. It was the end of the world, after all. As farewells went, it wasn't much, but it would have to do. And as Sleepy Jean might also have said, "It sure beats a poke in the eye with a rusty branding iron." Clay followed Alice and Tom out onto the porch, into the sound of soft autumn rain. Chapter 19. Tom had his trilby. There was a hood on Alice's poncho, and Tom had found Clay a Red Sox cap that would keep his head dry for a while at least, if the light rain didn't get heavier. And if it did, well, forage shouldn't be a problem, as Alice had pointed out. That would surely include foul weather gear. From the slight elevation of the porch, they could see roughly 2 blocks of Salem Street. It was impossible to be sure in the failing light, but it appeared completely deserted, except for a few bodies and the food litter the crazies had left behind. Each of them was wearing a knife, seated in scabbards Clay had made. If Tom was right about the Nickersons, they would soon be able to do better. Clay hoped so. He might be able to use the butcher knife from Soul Kitchen again, but he still wasn't sure he would be able to use it in cold blood. Alice held a flashlight in her left hand. She looked to make sure Tom had one too, and nodded.
Okay, she said. You take us to the Nickerson house, right?
Right, Tom said.
And if we see someone on our way there, we stop right away and put our lights on them.
She looked at Tom, then Clay, with some anxiety. They had been over this before. Clay guessed she probably obsessed the same way before big tests, and of course, this was a very big one.
Right, Tom said.
We say, our names are Tom, Clay, and Alice. We're normal. What are your names? Clay said, if they have flashlights like us, we can almost assume.
We can't assume anything, she said restlessly, querulously. My father says, assume makes an ass out of you and me. Get it? You and...
I get it, Clay said. Alice brushed at her eyes, although whether to wipe away rain or tears, Clay wasn't sure. He wondered briefly and painfully if Johnny was somewhere crying for him right now. Clay hoped he was. He hoped his son was still capable of tears, of memory.
If they can answer, if they can say their names, they're fine, and they're probably safe, Alice said. Right?
Right, Clay said. Yeah, Tom agreed, a little absently. He was looking at the street where there were no people and no bobbing flashlight beams near or far. Someplace in the distance, gunshots popped. They sounded like fireworks. The air stank of burning and char, and had all day. Clay thought they were smelling it more strongly now because it was wet. He wondered how long before the smell of decaying flesh turned the fog hanging over Greater Boston into a reek. He supposed it depended on how warm the days ahead turned out to be.
If we meet normal people and they ask us what we're doing or where we're going, remember the story, Alice said.
We're looking for survivors, Tom said.
That's right, because they're our friends and neighbors. Any people we meet will just be passing through. They'll want to keep moving. Later on, we'll probably want to hook up with other normal people because there's safety in numbers, but right now,
we'd like to get to those guns, Clay said, if there are any guns to get.
Come on, Alice, let's do this.
She looked worriedly at him.
What's wrong? What am I missing? You can tell me, I know I'm just a kid.
Patiently as he could with nerves that felt like overtuned guitar strings, Clay said,
There's nothing wrong with it, honey. I just want to get rolling. I don't think we're going to see anyone anyway. I think it's too soon. I hope you're right, she said. My hair's a mess, and I've chipped a nail.
They looked at her silently for a moment, then laughed. After that, it was better among them, and stayed better until the end. Chapter 20
No,
Alice said. She made a gagging sound.
No. No, I can't.
A louder gagging sound. Then,
I'm going to throw up. I'm sorry.
She plunged out of the Coleman's glare and into the gloom of the Nickerson's living room, which adjoined the kitchen via a wide arch. Clay heard a soft thump as she went to her knees on the carpet, then more gagging. A pause, a gasp, and then she was vomiting. He was almost relieved.
Oh, Christ, Tom said.
He pulled in a long, gasping breath, and this time spoke in a wavering exhalation that was nearly a howl.
Oh, Christ!
Tom, Clay said. He saw how the little man was swaying on his feet, and understood he was on the verge of fainting. Why not? These bloody leavings had been his neighbors. Tom! He stepped between Tom and the two bodies on the kitchen floor, between Tom and most of the splattered blood, which looked as black as India ink in the Coleman's unforgiving white glare. He tapped the side of Tom's face with his free hand. Don't pass out! And when he saw Tom steady on his feet, he dropped his voice a little. Go on in the other room and take care of Alice. I'll take care of the kitchen.
Why would you want to go in there?
Tom asked.
That's Beth Nickerson with her brains all over.
He swallowed. There was an audible click in his throat.
Most of her face is gone, but I recognize the blue jumper with the white snowflakes on it. And that's Heidi on the floor by the center island. Their daughter, I recognize her, even with...
He shook his head as if to clear it, then repeated,
Why would you want to?
I'm pretty sure I see what we came for, Clay said. He was astounded by how calm he sounded.
In the kitchen?
Tom tried to look past him, and Clay moved to block his view. Trust me. You see to Alice. If she can, you two start looking around for more guns. Shout if you hit pay dirt. And be careful, Mr. Nickerson may be here too. I mean, we could assume he was at work when all this went down, but as Alice's dad says...
Assume makes an ass out of you and me, Tom said.
He managed a sickly smile.
Gotcha.
He started to turn away, then turned back.
I don't care where we go, Clay, but I don't want to stay here any longer than we have to. I didn't exactly love Arnie and Beth Nickerson, but they were my neighbors, and they treated me a hell of a lot better than that idiot Scottoni from around the block.
Understood. Tom snapped on his flashlight and went into the Nickerson living room. Clay heard him murmuring to Alice, comforting her. Steeling himself, Clay walked into the kitchen with the Coleman lantern held up, stepping around the puddles of blood on the hardwood floor. It had dried now, but he still didn't want to put his shoes in any more of it than he had to. The girl lying on her back by the center island had been tall, but both her pigtails and the angular lines of her body suggested a child 2 or 3 years younger than Alice. Her head was cocked at a strenuous angle, almost a parody of interrogation, and her dead eyes bulged. Her hair had been broomstraw blonde, but all of it on the left side of her head, the side that had taken the blow which had killed her, was now the same dark maroon as the stains on the floor. Her mother reclined below the counter to the right of the stove, where the handsome cherrywood cabinets came together to form a corner. Her hands were ghost white with flour, and her bloody, bitten legs were indecorously splayed. Once, before starting work on a limited-run comic called Battle Hell, Clay had accessed a selection of fatal gunshot photos on the web, thinking there might be something he could use. There was not. Gunshot wounds spoke a terrible blank language of their own, and here it was again. Beth Nickerson was mostly spray and gristle from her left eye on up. Her right eye had drifted into the upper orbit of its socket, as if she had died trying to look into her own head. Her back hair and a good deal of her brain matter was caked on the cherrywood cabinet against which she had leaned in her brief moments of dying. A few flies were buzzing around her. Clay began to gag. He turned his head and covered his mouth. He told himself he had to control himself. In the other room, Alice had stopped vomiting. In fact, he could hear her and Tom talking together as they moved deeper into the house, and he didn't want to get her going again. Think of them as dummies. Props in a movie, he told himself, but he knew he could never do that. When he looked back, he looked at the other things on the floor instead. That helped. The gun he had already seen. The kitchen was spacious, and the gun was all the way on the other side, lying between the fridge and one of the cabinets with the barrel sticking out. His first impulse on seeing the dead woman and the dead girl had been to avert his eyes. They'd happened on the gun barrel purely by accident. But maybe I would have known there had to be a gun. He even saw where it had been. A wall-mounted clip between the built-in TV and the industrial-size can opener. They were gadget nuts as well as gun nuts, Tom had said. And a wall-mounted pistol in your kitchen just waiting to leap into your hand? Why, if that wasn't the best of both worlds, what was?
Clay?
That was Alice, coming from some distance.
What?
There followed the sound of her feet quickly ascending a set of stairs. Then Alice called from the living room.
Tom said you wanted to know if we hit pay dirt? We just did. There must be a dozen guns downstairs in the den. Rifles and pistols both. They're in a cabinet with an alarm company sticker on it, so we'll probably get arrested.
That's a joke.
Are you coming?
In a minute, hon. Don't come out here.
Don't worry. Don't you stay there and get grossed out.
He was beyond grossed out, far beyond. There were two other objects lying on the bloody hardwood floor of the Nickerson kitchen. One was a rolling pin, which made sense. There was a pie tin, a mixing bowl, and a cheery yellow canister marked flour sitting on the center island. The other object on the floor, this one lying not too distant from one of Heidi Nickerson's hands, was a cell phone only a teenager could love, blue with big orange daisy decals plastered all over it. Clay could see what had happened, little as he wanted to. Beth Nickerson is making a pie. Does she know something awful has started to happen in Greater Boston, in America, maybe in the world? Is it on TV? If so, the TV didn't send her a crazy gram. Clay was sure of that. Her daughter got one, though. Oh, yes. And Heidi attacked her mother. Did Beth Nickerson try to reason with her daughter before driving her to the floor with a blow from the rolling pin? Or did she just strike? Not in hate, but in pain and fear? In any case, it wasn't enough. And Beth wasn't wearing pants. She was wearing a jumper, and her legs were bare. Clay pulled down the dead woman's skirt. He did it gently, covering the plain, working-at-home underwear that she had soiled at the end. Heidi, surely no older than 14, and perhaps only 12, must have been growling in that savage, nonsense language they seemed to learn all at once after they got a full dose of sane be gone from their phones, saying things like Rast and Ila and Kazala Khan. The first blow from the rolling pin had knocked her down but not out, and the mad girl had begun to work on her mother's legs. Not little nips either, but deep, searing bites, some that had driven all the way to the bone. Clay could see not only tooth marks, but ghostly tattoos that must have been left by young Heidi's braces. And so, probably screaming, undoubtedly in agony, almost certainly not aware of what she was doing, Beth Nickerson had struck again, this time much harder. Clay could almost hear the muffled crack as the girl's neck broke. Beloved daughter, dead on the floor of the state-of-the-art kitchen, with braces on her teeth and her state-of-the-art cell phone by one outstretched hand. And had her mother stopped to consider before popping the gun from its clip between the TV and the can opener, where it had been waiting who knew how long for a burglar or rapist to appear in this clean, well-lighted kitchen? Clay thought not. Clay thought there would have been no pause, that she would have wanted to catch up with her daughter's fleeing soul while the explanation for what she had done was still fresh on her lips. Clay went to the gun and picked it up. From a gadget boy like Arnie Nickerson, he would have expected an automatic, maybe even one with a laser sight. But this was a plain old Colt 45 revolver. He supposed it made sense. His wife might feel more comfortable with this kind of gun. No nonsense about making sure it was loaded if the gun was needed, or wasting time fishing a clip out from behind the spatulas or spices if it wasn't. Then racking the slide to make sure there was a hot one in the chamber. No, with this old whore, you just had to swing the barrel out, which Clay did with ease. He'd drawn 1,000 variations of this very gun for Dark Wanderer. As he'd expected, only one of the 6 chambers was empty. He shook out one of the other loads, knowing just what he would find. Beth Nickerson's 45 was loaded with highly illegal cop-killer bullets. Fraggers. No wonder the top of her head was gone. The wonder was that she had any left at all. He looked down at the remains of the woman leaning in the corner and began to cry. Clay? That was Tom, coming up the stairs from the basement.
Man, Arnie had everything. There's an automatic weapon that would have gotten him a stretch in Walpole, I bet.
Clay, are you all right?
I'm coming, Clay said, wiping his eyes. He safetied the revolver and stuck it in his belt. Then he took off the knife and laid it on Beth Nickerson's counter, still in its homemade scabbard. He wouldn't be needing it anymore. It seemed they were trading up.
Give me 2 more minutes.
Yo!
Clay heard Tom clumping back to Arnie Nickerson's downstairs armory and smiled in spite of the tears still running down his face. Here was something he would have to remember. Give a nice little gay guy from Malden a room full of guns to play with, he starts to say yo, just like Sylvester Stallone. Clay started going through drawers. In the third one he tried, he found a heavy red box marked American Defender, 45 caliber, American Defender, 50 rounds. It was under the dish towels. He put the box in his pocket and went to join Tom and Alice. He wanted to get out of here now, and as quickly as possible. The trick would be getting them to go without trying to take Arnie Nickerson's entire gun collection along. Halfway through the arch, he paused and glanced back, holding the Coleman lantern high, looking at the bodies. Pulling down the skirt of the woman's jumper hadn't helped much. They were still just corpses, their wounds as naked as Noah when his son had come upon him in liquor. He could find something to cover them with, but once he started covering bodies, where would it end? Where? With Sharon? With his son? God forbid, he whispered. But he doubted that God would, simply because he asked. He lowered the lantern and followed the dancing glow of flashlights downstairs to Tom and Alice. Chapter 21. They both wore belts with large-caliber handguns in the holsters, and these were automatics. Tom had also slung an ammunition bandolier over his shoulder. Clay didn't know whether to laugh or start crying again. Part of him felt like doing both at the same time. Of course, if he did that, they would think he was having hysterics. And of course, they would be right. The plasma TV mounted on the wall down here was the big, very big, brother of the one in the kitchen. Another TV, only slightly smaller, had a multi-brand video game hookup Clay would once upon a time have loved to examine. To fawn over, maybe. As if to balance it off, a vintage Seaberg jukebox stood in the corner next to the Nickerson's ping-pong table, all its fabulous colors dark and dead. And of course there were the gun cabinets, two of them, still locked but with their glass fronts broken. There were locking bars, but he had a toolbox in his garage, Tom said. Alice used a wrench to break them off. They were cookies, Alice said modestly. This was in a garage behind the toolbox, wrapped in a piece of blanket. Is it what I think it is? She picked it up off the ping-pong table, holding it carefully by the wire stock, and carried it over to Clay. Holy shit, he said. This is... He squinted at the embossing above the trigger guard. I think it's Russian. I'm sure it is, Tom said. Do you think it's a Kalashnikov? Well, you got me. Are there bullets that match it? In boxes that match the printing on the gun, I mean? Half a dozen. Heavy boxes. It's a machine gun, isn't it? You might as well call it that, I guess. Clay flicked a lever. I'm pretty sure one of these positions is single shot and the other is auto fire. How many rounds does it fire a minute? Alice asked. I don't know, Clay said. But I think it's rounds per second. Whoa. Her eyes got round. Can you figure out how to shoot it? Alice, I'm pretty sure they teach 16-year-old farm boys how to shoot these. Yes, I can figure it out. It might take a box of ammo, but I can figure it out. Please God, don't let it blow up in my hands, he thought. Is something like that legal in Massachusetts? She asked. It is now, Alice, Tom said, not smiling. Is it time to go? Yes, she said. And then, perhaps still not entirely comfortable being the one to make the decisions, she looked at Clay. Yes, he said. North. Fine with me, Alice said. Yeah, Tom said. North. Let's do it. Gayton Academy. Chapter 1. When rainy daylight arose the next morning, Clay, Alice, and Tom were camped in the barn adjacent to an abandoned horse farm in North Reading. They watched from the door as the first groups of crazy folk began to appear, flocking southwest on Route 62 in the direction of Wilmington. Their clothes looked uniformly soaked and shabby. Some were without shoes. By noon they were gone. Around 4, as the sun broke through the clouds in long, spoking rays, they began flocking back in the direction from which they had come. Many were munching as they walked. Some were helping those who were having a hard time walking on their own. If there were acts of murder today, Clay, Tom, and Alice did not see any. Perhaps half a dozen of the crazies were lugging large objects that looked familiar to Clay. Alice had found one in the closet of Tom's guest bedroom. The three of them had stood around it, afraid to turn it on. Clay? Alice asked. Why are some of them carrying boomboxes? I don't know, he said. I don't like it, Tom said. I don't like the flocking behavior, I don't like them helping each other, and I like seeing them with those big portable sound systems least of all. There's only a few with, Clay began. Check her out, right there, Tom interrupted, pointing to a middle-aged woman who was staggering up Highway 62 with a radio CD player the size of a living room hassock cradled in her arms. She held it against her breasts as though it were a sleeping toddler. Its power cord had come out of the little storage compartment in back and dragged beside her on the road. And you don't see any of them carrying lamps or toasters, do you? But if they're programmed to set up battery-powered radios, turn them on, and start broadcasting that tone, pulse, subliminal message, whatever it is, what if they want to get the ones they missed the first time? They, the ever-popular paranoid they. Alice had produced her little sneaker from somewhere and was squeezing it in her hand, but when she spoke, her voice was calm enough. I don't think that's it, she said. Why not? Tom asked. She shook her head.
I can't say. Just that it doesn't feel right.
Woman's intuition?
He was smiling, but he wasn't sneering.
Maybe, she said. But I think one thing's obvious.
What's that, Alice? Clay asked. He had an idea what she was going to say, and he was right.
They're getting smarter. Not on their own, but because they're thinking together. Probably that sounds crazy, but I think it's more likely than them collecting a big pile of battery-powered FM suitcases to blast us all into Looney Land.
Telepathic groupthink? Tom said. He mulled it over. Alice watched him do it. Clay, who had already decided she was right, looked out the barn door at the last of the day. He was thinking they needed to stop somewhere and pick up a road atlas. Tom was nodding.
Hey, why not? After all, that's probably what flocking is. Telepathic groupthink.
Do you really think so, or are you just saying that to make me...
I really think so, he said.
He reached out and touched her hand, which was now squeezing the little sneaker rapidly.
I really, really do. Give that thing a rest, will you?
She gave him a fleeting, distracted smile. Clay saw it and thought again how beautiful she was, how really beautiful, and how close to breaking.
That hay looks soft and I'm tired. I think I'll take a nice long nap.
Get down with your bad self, Clay said. Chapter 2 Clay dreamed that he and Sharon and Johnny G were having a picnic behind their little house in Kent Pond. Sharon had spread her Navajo blanket on the grass. They were having sandwiches and iced tea. Suddenly the day went dark. Sharon pointed over Clay's shoulder and said,
Look, telepaths.
But when he turned that way, he saw nothing but a flock of crows, a flock so huge it blotted out the sun. Then a tinkling began. It sounded like the Mr. Softy truck playing the Sesame Street theme song, but he knew it was a ringtone, and in his dreams he was terrified. He turned back and Johnny G was gone. When he asked Sharon where he was, already dreading, already knowing the answer, she said Johnny had gone under the blanket to answer his cell phone. There was a bump in the blanket. Clay dove under, into the overpowering smell of sweet hay, shouting for Johnny not to pick up, not to answer, reaching for him and finding instead only the cold curve of a glass ball. The paperweight he'd bought in Small Treasures, the one with the haze of dandelion fluff, floating deep down inside like a pocket fog. Then Tom was shaking him, telling him it was past 9 by his watch, the moon was up, and if they were going to do some more walking, they ought to get at it. Clay had never been so glad to wake up. On the whole, he preferred dreams of the bingo tent. Alice was looking at him oddly.
What?
Clay said, checking to make sure their automatic weapon was safetied. That was already becoming second nature to him.
You were talking in your sleep. You were saying, don't answer it, don't answer it.
Nobody should have answered it, Clay said. We all would have been better off.
Ah, but who can resist a ringing phone? Tom asked. And there goes your ball game.
Thus spake fucking Zarathustra, Clay said. Alice laughed until she cried. Chapter 3 With the moon racing in and out of the clouds, like an illustration in a boy's novel of pirates and buried treasure, Clay thought, they left the horse farm behind and resumed their walk north. That night, they began to meet others of their own kind again. Because this is our time now, Clay thought, shifting the automatic rifle from one hand to the other. Fully loaded, it was damned heavy. The phone crazies own the days. When the stars come out, that's us. We're like vampires. We've been banished to the night. Up close, we know each other because we can still talk. At a little distance, we can be pretty sure of each other by the packs we wear and the guns more and more of us carry. But at a distance, the one sure sign is the waving flashlight beam. 3 days ago, we not only ruled the Earth, we had survivor's guilt about all the other species we'd wiped out on our climb to the nirvana of round-the-clock cable news and microwave popcorn. Now, we're the flashlight people. He looked over at Tom.
Where do they go? He asked. Where do the crazies go after sundown?
Tom gave him a look.
North Pole. All the elves died of mad reindeer disease, and these guys are helping out until the new crop shows up.
Jesus, Clay said. Did someone get up on the wrong side of the haystack tonight? But Tom still wouldn't smile.
I'm thinking about my cat, he said, wondering if he's all right. No doubt you think that's quite stupid.
No, Clay said, although having a son and a wife to worry about, he sort of did. Chapter 4 They got a road atlas in a card and book shop in the two-stoplight burg of Ballard Vale. They were now traveling north, and were very glad they had decided to stay in the more or less bucolic V between Interstates 93 and 95. The other travelers they met, most moving west, away from I-95, told of horrendous traffic jams and terrible wrecks. One of the few pilgrims who was moving east said that a tanker had crashed near the Wakefield exit of I-93, and the resulting fire had caused a chain of explosions that had incinerated nearly a mile of northbound traffic. The stench, he said, was like a fish fry in hell. They met more flashlight people as they trudged through the outskirts of Andover, and heard a rumor so persistent it was now repeated with the assurance of fact. The New Hampshire border was closed. New Hampshire state police and special deputies were shooting first and asking questions afterward. It didn't matter to them whether you were crazy or sane.
It's just a new version of the fucking motto they've had on their fucking license plate since forever, said a bitter-faced elderly man with whom they walked for a while.
He was wearing a small pack over his expensive topcoat and carrying a long-barreled flashlight. Poking out of his topcoat pocket was the butt of a handgun.
If you're in New Hampshire, you can live free. If you want to come to New Hampshire, you can fucking die.
That's just really hard to believe, Alice said.
Believe what you want, missy, said their temporary companion. I met some people who tried to go north like you folks, and they turned back south in a hurry when they saw some people shot out of hand trying to cross into New Hampshire north of Dunstable.
When? Clay asked.
Last night.
Clay thought of several other questions, but held his tongue instead. At Andover, the bitter-faced man and most of the other people with whom they had been sharing their vehicle-clogged but passable route turned onto Highway 133 toward Lowell and points west. Clay, Tom, and Alice were left on Andover's main street, deserted except for a few flashlight-waving foragers, with a decision to make.
Do you believe it? Clay asked Alice.
No,
she said, and looked at Tom. Tom shook his head.
Me either. I thought the guy's story had an alligators in the sewers feel to it.
Alice was nodding.
News doesn't travel that fast anymore, not without phones.
Yep, Tom said. Definitely the next generation urban myth. Still, we are talking about what a friend of mine likes to call New Hampster, which is why I think we should cross the border at the most out-of-the-way spot we can find.
Sounds like a plan, Alice said. And with that, they moved on again, using the sidewalk as long as they were in town and there was a sidewalk to use.
Chapter 5 On the outskirts of Andover, a man with a pair of flashlights rigged in a kind of harness, one light at each temple, stepped out through the broken display window of the IGA. He waved to them in companionable fashion, then picked a course toward them between a jumble of shopping carts, dropping canned goods into what looked like a newsboy's pouch as he walked. He stopped beside a pickup truck lying on its side, introduced himself as Mr. Roscoe Hant of Methuen, and asked where they were going. When Clay told them Maine, Hant shook his head.
New Hampshire border's closed. I met two people not half an hour ago got turned back. He said they're trying to tell the difference between the phone crazies and people like us, but they're not trying too hard.
Did these two people actually see this with their own eyes? Tom asked.
Roscoe Hant looked at Tom as though he might be crazy.
You gotta trust the word of others, man, he said. I mean, you can't exactly phone someone up and ask for verification, can you?